The topic tonight is determination or resolve. Determination is one of the 10 paramis. The paramis are known as the 10 perfections. They're qualities of character that lead to awakening. They include generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. What differentiates a quality of character as a parami is whether it's associated with liberation and compassion. For instance, you can have a lot of determination as a bank robber, but that doesn't make it a skillful quality, as it is if you're helping someone. Aditana is the Pali word for determination. It means a determination that's not shaken under any condition, like a mountain not moved at all by a storm that passes. It's associated to the Thai word aditan, which means vow. I'd like to read a little piece from an article by Tanisha Bhikkhu. The Buddha said, "The purpose of practice is to see what you've never seen before, to realize what you've never realized before. And many of these things that you've never seen or realized lie outside the limits of your imagination. In order to see them, you have to learn how to push yourself more than you might imagine. But this has to be done with skill. That's why the Buddha said that a good determination involves four qualities: discernment, truth, relinquishment, and peace." And I'm going to talk about each one of those four qualities. Discernment is the ability to make skillful judgments. In relation to determination, discernment means two things. It means setting a wise goal and knowing how to achieve the goal. To set a wise goal, you need to know why you want what you want, and if it's a skillful goal. An example of a long-term goal in meditation is the goal of awakening or liberation. You need to keep reminding yourself why you're meditating, about what the meditation really means in terms of your future, that you want true happiness, you want dependable happiness, the sort of happiness that will stay with you through thick and thin. In the short term, there are many useful goals, and those goals support your long-term goal. You might decide, I'm going to meditate every day this month, or I'm going to be mindful of every single breath in the next hour, or I'm not going to move during the sitting. Another example of a long-term goal could be wise speech. You might decide, my speech will be kind and thoughtful. I'll listen well, I'll no longer lie, speak harshly, or gossip. A short-term goal that could support that, because that's quite a big chunk to try to accomplish, especially if you don't have those habits. What you might want to say to yourself is, today I won't talk about anybody else. It's difficult to sustain practice without a goal. For you might start wondering why you're here, why you're meditating, and why you aren't out sitting on the beach or watching a movie. Once you've established what your goal is, you need to clearly understand how to achieve it, what steps to take, and how to stay inspired in the long run. Once you understand the steps, then you turn your attention from the goal and you focus on the steps that will take you there. You then focus more on what you do than on the results you hope to get. You may shift your attention from wanting to be liberated to the short-term goal of, I'm going to be mindful of every breath for the next hour. Each and every one. An example is the goal of running a marathon. Once you've decided that this is a skillful goal, then you decide how to train for it. You may research the best way to train, talk to others who've done it. Once you have your plan, then you shift your focus to actually doing it. You may choose to run every day and gradually increase your distance. Now your focus gets narrower. You focus on today's sub-goal. Today you're going to walk one lap and jog one lap. And then your focus turns into the present moment and you start paying attention to how your body feels. This step, this step. And the next day you again remind yourself, okay, I want to do a marathon. So that reminds you, you know, why you're running. And then you focus on today's new sub-goal, which might be, I'm going to run 2 laps today. And then again, you shift your focus while actually running into the body now. In making the plan, it's really important to focus and to consider how to stay inspired in the long run. It helps to daily remember your primary goal. If you want to run a marathon, you might find a running buddy. You might start reading books and magazines about running. With meditation, you could have as your primary goal the goal of awakening, or some people have a goal of stress reduction. If you're clear that your goal is awakening, you may decide to follow the Eightfold Path that the Buddha laid out. You may choose to meditate every day, try to be mindful all day, to sit retreats, to give up getting intoxicated. Then you would shift your focus to today's sub-goals. You're going to meditate 45 minutes. You might commit to be mindful while you're eating, or commit to be mindful while you're walking to the car. And then as you enter each activity, now you change your focus and you focus into the actual experience. If you're meditating, you focus on your breath. If you're eating, you focus on how the food tastes, on your chewing, on how your body feels while you're eating. When you go walk in the car, you might focus on the sensations at the bottoms of your feet. To stay inspired, you might remind yourself of the larger goal each day by reading Dharma books, reading poetry, keeping a journal, talking with friends, listening to Dharma talks. The second quality needed for determination is truth. Truth can be simply doing what you say you will do to yourself and to others. Only when you do that can you trust yourself. This is where I like to remind myself of one of the meanings of the word determination, which is vow. To treat our words and commitments as a vow, there's a quality of honor we think of when we make and keep a vow. I think it's a powerful way to approach giving our word, including to ourselves. You might want to consider in your life, do you keep your word? Do you do what you say will do? Are you timely? Another factor about truth is being truthful about our experience, about how we feel. This requires mindfulness. If we're struggling in pursuing our goal, we need to investigate what's causing the struggle. It's usually one of the 5 hindrances: desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth and torpor, or doubt. For example, if your intention is to get up and meditate at 6 o'clock in the morning, and you're in bed and it's warm and you don't want to get up, is desire present? Are you clinging to comfort? Or you just don't want to get out of bed because it's cold out there? That's aversion. Just by recognizing what it is that's in the way of you pursuing your goal, sometimes it's enough to loosen its hold on you. Sometimes we're feeling lazy. But it's important to recognize that laziness is an attitude. It's an activity of the mind. It's something we do. It actually takes energy to be lazy. Have you ever really felt, you know, feel like lazy, you don't want to do anything, but you find yourself like anxiously tapping? I remember in college, there was nothing that could put me to sleep faster than my histology class. That's microscopic anatomy. And it didn't matter how I felt, I'd get into that class and just my eyes would close. And, you know, as soon as the class was over, I'd be wide awake and energetic. And at the time, I wasn't practicing mindfulness, so I didn't realize that I just had a lot of resistance to learning this material. I really did not want to learn those details. Didn't find them relevant in my life. And that resistance, which was a lot of energy, exhausted me, you know, made me tune it out. It's important to notice the qualities of doubt and resistance when they're present in relation to our goals. They can build unnoticed and they undermine our determination. The third quality needed for determination is relinquishment. There are always things you have to give up in pursuit of any goal. In the Dhammapada, it says, if you see a greater happiness that comes from forsaking a lesser happiness, be willing to forsake the lesser happiness for the sake of the greater one. We often give up a greater happiness for a quick pleasure. For example, you may have high blood pressure and you need to stay on a low-salt diet, but you're tempted and you have some potato chips. You risk your health for a quick pleasure. Or in meditation, you might sleep in, which gives you an immediate brief pleasure, but then you break the momentum of sitting daily. And then meditation doesn't become a habit. And without it becoming a habit, it doesn't deepen. You may get a quick pleasure from gossiping about someone. But after that, you may feel more distant from the person you talked about. And the person you gossip to might start wondering, God, did they talk about me that way? And then it creates another barrier between you and that person. And therefore, it undermines your desire to be happy. The fourth factor of determination is peace. The easiest way to know if the determination is skillful is if there's greater peace. If the goal you're pursuing does not bring more peace, it's not a skillful goal. It's also very important to keep the mind calm and peaceful as you work towards the goal. For instance, an athlete who trains really hard, they can be very determined. But if they're not peaceful, without that quality, they get very stressed, they get tight, and they get injured. And they don't do as well. When athletes talk about being in the zone, it's a time of peace. The zone feels very still. And that's when people perform the best. Without peace, determination is stress-producing. A workaholic can have a lot of determination, but it's obsessive and not skillful. They're always leaning into the future. By focusing calmly on the step right in front of you, instead of rushing forward with your mind, one is able to stay peaceful in the process. Determination must include acceptance of who we are right now. Even as we might be determined to improve ourselves, it's essential to accept ourselves as we are right now, not to reject who we are. Acceptance brings a sense of peace and ease and spaciousness to the situation. But acceptance does not mean becoming complacent. It takes mindfulness to not become complacent. The question is, are we putting out our best effort? Our best effort looks different depending on a condition, on conditions. For instance, if you get up in the morning and you go meditate and you're really energetic and you're really feeling good, and you have this wonderful sitting, and you know your best effort, your mind just stays on the breath, and you know, and is able to be very mindful. You know, and that's easy to say, God, I'm really putting out a good effort right now. But let's say you get up the next day and you know you've got a cold and you didn't sleep well, and you're tired and you're barely able to concentrate. And what's your best effort then? It doesn't really matter how, you know, how well you concentrate. It matters that you're putting out your best effort in that condition. It's very easy to undermine ourselves, you know, like saying, oh, well, I'm sick, so it doesn't count. Or I'm tired, and I'm not going to try. There are many different aids to calming the mind when you're not in sitting meditation. We all kind of know how to do it when we're sitting. Just by sitting still, the body tends to calm, the mind tends to calm. But when we're out in the rest of our lives doing different things, it's very easy to just get ahead of ourselves. And one of the most useful things that I've found throughout the day is to just take a couple of deep breaths, long deep breaths, just every couple hours, you know, just to calm myself and get back in the present. Another really, really wonderful method is to just check in on your abdomen. Is your abdomen relaxed? How many of us are spending most of the day just tense right in the middle? Other things you can do is, some people like to use phrases like relax, let go. Sometimes I've used, it's called a gatha, it's a small poem. This one is by Thich Nhat Hanh. And I've just used it throughout the day at different times just to remind myself to come back to the present. Breathing in, I calm body and mind. Breathing out, I smile. Being in the present moment, I know it is the only moment. When determination is skillful, it can feel like grace. It may still be challenging, but there's a sense of relaxation and peace. Like Thomas Jefferson said, I'm a great believer in luck, and I find that the harder I work, the more I have of it. I want to talk a little bit about motivation. Determination is a decision. The driving force is intention. The clarity of our intention is important. What do I want and why do I want it? Determination is dependent on our honesty about what we want. We may want something because we think we should want it. Many years ago, I thought I wanted to live on a farm and grow my own vegetables. And a lot of my friends, you know, who wanted the same thing, and they went ahead and did it. I mean, they went in those directions. And, you know, I intellectually thought that that was the right way to live, but I didn't really want to do it. So I just kind of looked at the farm catalogs and read about it and never did it. But it took me a long time to realize I didn't really want to do it. And so I actually suffered a lot from it because I wasn't doing what I thought I wanted to do, and I kept failing at it. And it just took me a while to really get that that wasn't what I wanted. We often lose sight of why we want something. Let's say I'm planning a trip to South America and I want to, you know, want to learn the language. At first I may study Spanish diligently, lots of energy, but then slowly my enthusiasm wanes. So I need to remind myself, why do I want to learn Spanish? By focusing on the why, the motivation strengthens. Motivation can come either from desire or from aversion. Desire and aversion are not the enemies. For example, let's say my back hurts and I don't like it. I don't want it to hurt. That's aversion. But as I pay attention to the aversion, I may ask myself, is there something skillful I can do in this situation? Is there anything I can help it with? And so I may decide to start doing yoga. So the motivation to do yoga might come from not wanting to hurt. An example of using desire as motivation may be after a retreat. The retreat experience might have been really intense and wonderful, and when I come home, I just want to have more of it. So it inspires me to want to sit more regularly and longer. And that's motivation from desire. Determination depends on faith or confidence. Confidence is built on the experience of many small successes. For instance, I remember learning the piano and playing the first phrase of Jingle Bells. You know, just these little three notes, you know, jingle bells, you know, and realizing, wow, it really sounds like a song. And it just gave me the confidence to be able to want to try something a little bit harder. Confidence can arise from seeing someone else who has done it. I remember when I started jogging, my husband told me that I would soon be able to jog 2 miles. And at that time, the most I'd ever jogged was one lap, and it had been challenging. But because of his confidence and his experience, I opened my mind and to the possibility that I might be able to do it, and it might be easier than I think. And within a short period of time, I was able to jog the distance. So it was his confidence in his experience that gave me the confidence to open that possibility for myself. And that's, you know, that's what we do with a mentor, using someone who actually has done or is further along the path than we are. There are many things you can do to help maintain our motivation. Henry Beecher said, "It's easier to go down a hill than up it, but the view is much better at the top." I'm just going to go over a few different things that we can do. There's a lot of things we can do to maintain our motivation. The first thing is to declare what you want. It really helps if you simply, in simple words, are able to articulate what it is you want. Sometimes people have very vague, grandiose ideas of what they want, especially when it comes to their spiritual practice. But you ask them, well, what do you want? And they're kind of like, well, you know, this kind of big general thing. And I think it's very helpful in any skillful goal that we may have to actually be able to articulate it simply. And for some people, it's very helpful to write it down. Knowing why we want it, I think, is crucial in maintaining our motivation. Be clear about your reasons for it. I find it useful to read it a few times a day, but any way of reminding yourself works. I sort of like the idea of, you know, in Islam, you know, they pray 5 times a day. You know, that's a great thing to do with your primary spiritual goal, to focus on it at least 5 times a day throughout the day. Maybe when you first wake up, maybe at meals, maybe right before you go to sleep. Another thing that is very helpful is visualization. Visualize what you want with as many senses as possible. Include words, a visual, a physical felt sense, and an emotional tone. For instance, let's say you want to learn ballroom dancing. You might imagine yourself, seeing yourself dancing. That's like a visual. And then you can imagine how it feels in your body. Kind of imagine how your body feels in the movement. And then imagine how you feel emotionally. You know, how happy it makes you, lighthearted, smiling. There have been many studies showing that using mental imagery improves performance in sports. Mental imagery can improve specific motor skills and also enhances motivation, confidence, all of which help elevate the level of performance. I think, I don't remember the name of the football coach, but the entire team has been taught meditation. And from what I hear, they've done really well, but somebody else might know about that. When you visualize, you're actually creating neural patterns in your brain, just as if you had physically performed an action. Determination requires diligence, energy, active engagement, a warrior attitude. It helps when you visualize that you include that emotional tone. So if you're picturing yourself, you know, let's say you're meditating for stress reduction, you want to really keep in mind, visualize that emotional tone of like, oh, I'm really relaxed and I'm happy and I'm peaceful. When practicing for the goal, it's important to switch the focus to the process, to the steps of the goal. This is where mindfulness is essential. Pay attention. What's the best energy available to me at this moment? Energy is often available if we focus. What's important is the continuity of our best effort, not peak performance. Pay attention to anything that might prevent your best effort. Let's say I'm jogging and I plan to jog 3 miles. At about 2 miles, my energy is low and I want to stop. So I might ask myself, what's the real reason I want to stop right now? Is it that I enjoy running when I have lots of energy and it's not as much fun now? Or do I really have a reason? Am I going to get injured or it's unhealthy for me to jog right now? And the mind plays tricks, you know, and I've seen it in myself. You know, I've been able to psych myself out of wanting to quit quite easily. It's helpful to create a container or support for carrying out our intentions. In a meditation practice, you might want to have a place where you sit every day. Do it at the same time every day. Maybe read an inspiring quote. Other examples of support might be a study group, a writing group, keeping a journal, having a buddy you talk to, a mentor, a ritual, poetry, coming to Dharma talks. I want to use an example of my life, from my life, to show how the four qualities of determination relate to an actual choosing a goal and following through with it. The four qualities, again, are discernment, truth, relinquishment, and peace. About 6 years ago, my husband and I had found it intriguing that Theravada monks don't eat after noon, and we discussed the possibility of doing what they do many times. It seemed like a good idea, but I wasn't sure either of us could sustain it. But about 6 years ago, while I was away on retreat, he started doing it. After a couple of months, seeing that he was able to do it, I joined him. But first, first thing we used was discernment. We had to decide if it was a skillful thing to do. And then we had to decide how to go about it. So we spoke to a few monks and asked them about their energy levels, their health, how it affected their practice. The fact that thousands of monks all over the world do this gave us confidence that that it was okay to do it. Then the monks, they stopped eating after noon. And initially, that's what we were going to do. But as we looked at our lives as lay people, we decided it was important to still be able to at least share a meal with one meal with friends. So we changed it to 2 o'clock instead of noon. Using the quality of truth, I asked myself why I wanted to do it. I wanted to make food less important in my life. I wanted to simplify it. It was the practice of renunciation. The third quality, relinquishment, meant giving up more than food when I stopped eating after 2. It meant giving up a certain kind of socializing and entertainment. Thanksgiving dinner just isn't the same when you're not eating. Even though I'm comfortable not eating when others are, sometimes it makes others uncomfortable. But we were inspired, knowing that it nourished a kind of peace, the fourth quality. By simplifying our lives, there was less cooking, less shopping, less dishes, less money spent, less planning meals, less obsessing about food. One of the things that really helped was visualizing the thousands of monks all over the world who live this way every day. When we asked Ajahn Amaro, who's a monk up in Ukiah, he said it took him 2 weeks before he got used to it. They helped give us the faith during the first, more difficult phase. We also did this together, which gave us tremendous support. Then it soon became effortless, something we rarely think about. I'd like to end the talk with a poem by Mary Oliver. It's called The Journey, and I think it's about determination. One day, you finally knew what you had to do and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried. But you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do. Though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible, it was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones. But little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Good question. It's probably before that the 10 armies, and I don't know if it's just in Tibetan tradition or not, but sometimes it's 6. They call them 6 paramitas. They include generosity, patience, energy,
they add concentration.
And concentration.
Yeah. Yes, they are. Paramita is a Sanskrit word, whereas parmi is the Pali word. And in the Mahayana tradition, which includes Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, they do have the 6 qualities. The Turban tradition is older, and they had the 10. So it got changed at some point. Any other questions? Let me ask you a question. Okay. How many of you, did any of you make New Year's resolutions this year? Nobody?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. Did you make a resolution to make a resolution? Did anybody make one last year? Did you keep them? Great. So when you did that, did you make a plan for how to do it? I mean, I don't know if you want to share, you know, if it's too per. Well, thank you. Yeah, doing that, the small steps, you know, that's how we build confidence. And, you know, you think about, you know, the ideal of practice is to actually be awake every moment of the day. Every thought counts. Every action counts. There isn't a moment to just to wait and get over and get past. Everything counts. And, you know, I forget, one of my teachers said once, you know, it's like with mindfulness, you know. So every moment that you practice mindfulness throughout the day builds a habit where we gradually become more and more mindful throughout more and more of the day. And what she used was the idea of, you know, filling a bucket. You know, it's like, you know, one drop, you look at this huge bucket and you see one drop of water, it feels like, oh my God, it's going to take forever. But still, one drop at a time. And all of a sudden you see, oh, it's like a third of the way full. You know, it gives you confidence. Okay, I will keep practicing mindfulness. Okay. What I personally have done for mindfulness practice during the day is I have like a couple of activities which I'm always mindful at. That's brushing my teeth and washing the dishes. And sometimes when I eat. And you know, so at least those things are times when I kind of automatically am, I'm so conditioned that I don't have to try. I just automatically go there and this is my time. It's like a meditation practice, my brushing my teeth practice. So if anybody who didn't would like to share this, if you had a resolution at any year, doesn't matter which year, that you didn't follow through, do you know why? Yes.
I eat too much. I don't eat healthy foods. I've had trouble making resolutions and keeping. I've made resolutions too many times and got kept up on them. I've only begun to succeed on that in the last 6 months when I was finally able to tie weight loss into spirituality. Before I saw it as related, it didn't seem to matter as much to me.
And how did you do that? How did you tie it into spirituality?
I found a church. I'm from San Jose. We're visiting here today. And I found a church in San Jose which did a weight loss that was tied into their spirituality. It was with New Thought, with Brain Science, on that menu. Now I'm beginning to get more spiritual over time, and I'm seeing that it's not just a relationship between ultimate reality and resolution, but it's an entire attitude towards eating and towards respect for animals and other things that I wasn't really aware of before. And I'm hoping that as I come here, that this will help me go deeper and ultimately clean up my stomach.
Thank you. Anybody else? You know, I spoke about the idea of creating a container that supports your practice or supports your goal. Would anybody like to share what inspires them, what they have in their life that supports their daily practice? Anything else you might do? Do you remind yourself while you're practicing? Do any of you do that?
It helps me a lot to read. I wish I would practice more and sit more, but I love to read all kinds of Buddhist books, like The Wings of Awakening, which is really sort of complex, or things like Thich Nhat Hanh, which are more accessible. But I like the whole range of Buddhist books for my inspiration.
I'm seeing the clarity that friends that I have that practice or are more mindful than I am, I see the clarity that it gives them, and that's an inspiration, because I want to be more clear about things I didn't know how to run. So that's an inspiration to see how it affects them and stuff. The more I understand where they're coming from, why they are the way they are, because of their mindfulness. So we can continue.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
I find that probably my strongest consistent motivator is just suffering. It's just the running into difficulty when I don't practice and not typically dealing with it skillfully, but when I'm kind of out of practice. So that tends to bring me back. I find that the times when I'm most kind of drawn to it is extremely difficult periods of frustration or fear or something like that. Really, really into it. So
what you need now is how to keep yourself inspired when things are great.
Right, yeah, that's the biggest. But when I'm really feeling fine or joyful, then it's very hard to stay with it.
Yeah, one of my teachers said that he noticed that the he has a monastery, you know, and he, that the monks that would really, really put their hearts into it were people who were dying or ill or had major, major suffering in their lives. And they would progress the fastest because they were the most motivated. That that's like the first noble truth, you know, that there is suffering. And I think what happens is that we lose contact with that, you know, when things seem to be okay or when we're very distracted.
Yeah, I remember reading something by Matt Flickstein where he was talking about that as the Buddha kind of understanding as a basic psychology that we won't change unless we perceive the pain of continuing our behavior to be less than the change, than the pain required to change our behavior. So like people who all of a sudden become diagnosed with lung cancer will all of a sudden, you know, become really motivated to stop smoking. So by laying it out very, very clearly in the form of the truths,
yeah, I think we have a lot of the behaviors we have numb us from that awareness of our own pain. It's very easy we have so much access to entertainment, you know, in this culture, and it's very easy to just, you know, not feel, you know, when things aren't right. So are there ways, you know, the Buddha said, you know, we should give up a lesser happiness for greater happiness. Are there ways right now in your life that you're giving up a greater happiness for lesser happiness? How about the other way around? Are there ways you're giving up lesser happiness for greater happiness?
I'm noticing is that it's clearly a very difficult subject. Often subjects call great response from the room. And in this case, I notice, you know, there's a certain reluctance. I notice it's clearly a very difficult issue. And one of the questions I have always is that when there's a passage that interests me, that it's one of the shorter suttas with a devata asks the Buddha, you know, how do you cross the great stream? And he says, without pushing forward and without standing still. When I pushed forward, I was whirled about, and when I stood still, it sank. And that's what seems so difficult, is when we set ourselves great, you know, goals. I mean, you're speaking about a very skillful set of guidelines, and unless the set of guidelines is very skillfully used, it's possible just to push and push and be whirled about, and end up bewildered and frustrated. And standing still also doesn't do anything. I mean, one just becomes mired. And the concept of the greater happiness is a concept. I mean, it's not, we don't actualize that. We don't realize that actual happiness until we've done something for a very, very long time. So we have no surety that we're going to achieve at all. Or that the little glimpses that we may have transitory. So it's a clear, I mean, I think it's a very difficult issue. I'm not asking a question. I'm just expressing bewilderment.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Cheryl.
Well, I was just going to say, this reminds me of just a little imagery popped through my head about how, you know, if you can imagine yourself on this river, and you're in this little, say, kayak or small boat, and you're rowing away, and you're going, you think, you know, you're going, you're not sure upriver or downriver, but you're hoping it's the right direction, you're rowing away. And at some point you realize that it's your overall effect is, yes, waking you up to the fact that you're sitting there rowing, but the river is carrying you, because you're, first of all, made the decision to get in the boat, to go there. Do you know what I mean? It's like there's a working together between your intention and the situations you find yourself in every day. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it's kind of like that quote I said, you know, about luck. You know, the harder I work, the more luck I get.
Yeah. We just roll along.
Yeah.
And then, wow, where I'm at in the middle of this river, going someplace.
Yeah, I think that, you know, going back to what Lewis was saying, you know, in terms of, you know, like that quality of pushing too hard, you know, and that's what I really like about what the Buddha said about, you know, making peace a really important part, because that tells you right away whether you're pushing too hard. And the other part is getting confidence, you know, and I guess those little glimpses that might be temporary, still, they're, I guess they would inspire us. You know, they're definitely inspiring to me. You know, because each time I get one of those glimpses of like this deeper, much deeper peace, and I see over the years I get more and more of them. You know, so something feels like it's, you know, it's in the right direction. I had another very simple question. In terms of keeping your word, do you find it easier to keep your word to yourself or to keep your word to others?
To others.
To others? Have anybody else? I'm just sort of curious. How many find it easier to keep their word to others than to themselves? So that's the majority. That's interesting. Anybody?
Yourself, there's nobody to say that you aren't doing it.
I heard somebody say recently, in order to keep a daily practice, it's helpful to consider it an appointment with the Buddha instead of, you know, just something that I have to do. It's like, you know, Buddha.
Steve? Yeah, it makes you think about, you know, are we giving a word because of our deep integrity or because of our image? So that's why, you know, I think it's so really important to look at the quality of keeping our word to ourselves. Because, like, you know, if you think about, you know, if you have a friend, you tell them, yeah, I'll meet you for dinner tomorrow, and you don't show up. You know, you do it, not, you know, time after time. Eventually, they think you're a flake. You know, and so when we do that to ourselves, you know, it really, you know, affects our level of self-respect. Well, Raja Yoga is, I mean, yoga, there's a lot of different yogas, so I'm not sure. Raja Yoga, but it's the, I'm not all that versed in it. It's like the king of yogas, which includes a lot of the mental disciplines. And from what I know of Raja Yoga, it's basically, in terms of the practice itself, it's a concentration practice. Where, I mean, there's a lot more to it, and I'm not familiar with it, but the actual meditation itself doesn't includes merging with the one. That's really the focus of yoga. Yoga means union. You know, so it doesn't necessarily look at the other qualities of mind. It really kind of bypasses the rest of the mind with the goal of this union or absorption in the one. And whereas in this particular type of practice that we teach, your mindfulness practice, we include everything into our practice. I'm sure there's parts of Raja Yoga that may include daily life, but I'm not really familiar with that. So
yes, there are.
Yeah. I mean that's just the one practice that I recall from it. You know, I'm familiar with like the hatha yoga approaches, you know, the actual physical practices. You know, that's more, you know, and some concentration practices, but not that much with the rest. Yes?
Can you describe, as I understood, Buddhism, it aims towards nirvana. And would other mindfulness practices all lead in that direction, or are you aiming at a number of goals at once in terms of the mind?
Traditionally, you know, from what's taught is the purpose of mindfulness is nirvana, is the deathless liberation, being awake. What that is has lots of interpretations. So in terms of aiming for other things in the mind, in this particular practice, for instance, the idea of absorption is just it's a mental practice, but it's not the goal. So I'm not sure if that answers your question. You know, we could have a lot more discussion about it. So thank you, everyone.